American Sterling Bank versus Johnny Management LV Inc. Good morning, counsel. And Mr. Gerard, are you ready?
I am.
Good morning, Chief Justice Perigary and other justices. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of time for any rebuttal that might be necessary. In this case, the issues presented are straightforward and, I believe, necessary to clarify the law of Nevada as it relates to the doctrine of equitable subrogation. The issues to be addressed are, number one, whether a difference in the loan terms between the subrogee's new loan and the pre-existing subrogor's loan to which the subrogee is seeking to be equitably subrogated, sounds like a mouthful, doesn't it, can constitute the material prejudice necessary to prevent the application of equitable subrogation. And stated another way, should a change in terms between the original loan that was satisfied and the new loan that was put into place, the proceeds of which were used to satisfy the pre-existing loan, should a change in terms between those two loans ever constitute material prejudice to an intervening lien holder, and if so, under what circumstances? In 2003, this court took the opportunity to clarify the application of equitable subrogation in Nevada, and specifically decided the issue of whether a lender who pays off a prior note is equitably subrogated to the former lender's priority lien position. This court concluded that the subsequent lender does indeed succeed to the prior lender's priority lien position as long as an intervening lien holder is not materially prejudiced. And of course, that was the Houston decision. In Houston, this court looked at the three most widely followed approaches to equitable subrogation on the issue of a lender who pays off a prior note and adopted the approach set forth by the Restatement Third of Property Mortgages, Section 7.6. Section 7.6 of the Restatement provides one who fully performs an obligation of another secured by a mortgage, and here's the language I'd like you to focus on, becomes, by subrogation, the owner of the obligation and the mortgage to the extent necessary to prevent unjust enrichment. Even though the performance would otherwise discharge the obligation and the mortgage, they are preserved, and the mortgage retains its priority in the hands of the subrogee. It is this restatement language, becomes by subrogation the owner of the obligation and the mortgage, that I'd respectfully request become the focus of this court's inquiry. The introductory language to the restatement explains this language by stating, the effect of subrogation is to assign the mortgage and the obligation to the person performing, termed in the restatement the payor, by operation of law, rather than discharging them. The payor thus becomes the subrogee. After performing the obligation, the subrogee is entitled to receive upon request a formal written assignment of those rights. Such an assignment may be placed in the public records and may be helpful in ensuring that others recognize the subrogee's rights.
Was that done in this case?
I'm sorry?
Was that done in this case?
The request made after the fact? No. Because we obviously sought a declaration from the district court, which was not granted. Otherwise, it would have been requested in the order.
So, Mr. Gerard, if it had been done, even though the deed of reconveyance had been recorded by that of the second steward trust deed, that would void the deed of reconveyance. That's your position?
Under the restatement, that's exactly what it would do. The restatement reasons that by operation of law, at the time that the payment is made to satisfy the pre-existing loan, it is as if an assignment has been made of that loan. No different than if the subsequent lender simply purchased the earlier loan.
So in this case, though, we are, since that was not done, we're left to this argument as to whether or not this is prejudicial or not in terms of the loan and the...
I think that argument would be, in effect, irrespective of whether an actual assignment was made in the fashion we've described. Because obviously in the context of paying off a pre-existing lien, No one ever asks for a formal written assignment. It's only after the fact that one would be requested, unless, of course, you were actually purchasing that pre-existing loan.
Let's assume that the request had been made. In this instance, the due date on your note is much, much shorter than the due date of the note or mortgage that it secures that is to be assigned. Which due date applies on the assigned mortgage?
Well, I think under the restatement, Justice Hardesty, you've hit really the nail on the head. The restatement talks about the fact that you step into the shoes of the lien that was paid off.
Well, for illustration, illustration 29 of the restatement says that's true with respect to interest rate. It really doesn't address term. And why should the court allow for a much shorter term, or do we simply conclude, because it's equitable subordination, that the due date is the due date on the original note you've received?
I think you're asking more than one question. Let me see if I can handle them one at a time.
I'd get them all out there.
As to the first question, the illustrations as set forth in the restatement, and it says that in the introductory comments, are illustrative only. They're not intended to be exhaustive. If you read the actual restatement language, it makes it clear that you're stepping into the shoes of the lien that you paid off and that you receive all of the rights of the pre-existing note that was paid off, the right to enforce it on the terms of the note that you're stepping into the shoes of. No different than if I purchased that pre-existing loan. I would only be able to exercise the rights on that pre-existing note. So for purposes of your question, let's assume, as it is in this case, that there is a shorter term on the new note than on the original note. What that would mean is that for purposes of enforcement, if my client forecloses its own deed of trust that it obtained, which is arguably in a fourth position at the time that it was received, there's no prejudice to the intervening lien holder because it's foreclosing something that is junior to the intervening lien holder's lien. If, however, it wants to foreclose its equitably subrogated position, which is a senior position, it may only do so upon the terms of the note that it steps into the shoes of. Otherwise, there would be prejudice to the intervening lien holder. For that reason, the terms of the note, just as if it was acquired by purchase, have to be enforced, and in that fashion, the intervening lien holder is in no worse position than they were at any point in time. The risk that they assume when they take a junior lien, which in this case they clearly knew they were taking, is a risk that every junior lien holder always takes. It's a risk that the senior lien may be foreclosed upon, that they may be have to collect from their security only. As long as their security position has not been impaired, if they have the same collateral with the same value of collateral, there can be no impairment because they have exactly the same position they've always had. No restatement cases address.
Your argument here is slightly different than what I understood in the briefs because you've spent a lot of time or appear to about how to account for and allocate payments.
That's because that was a point of confusion to the district court judge. The argument that we made, if you look at the brief we submitted in the record to the trial court, makes it very clear that we believe that we stand in the shoes of the lien that was paid off, which is the restatement position, and that those are the only rights that we would be able to enjoy, which is exactly why we argue that there can be no prejudice as a result of the change in terms. The real inquiry by the district court should have been not should equitable subrogation be granted. It clearly should have been. It should have been to what extent. We will not allow equitable subrogation for the additional amount over and above what was necessary to pay off the old loan. There is significant body of case law that clearly provides that my client, once it steps into the shoes of that earlier note by subrogation, would have the right to exercise all those rights, including to be compensated for the accrual of interest, default interest, payment of fees and costs, late charges, attorney's fees, those types of things that are provided for in the other note, in the pre-existing note.
That made clear your position as to the extent to the district court, and more specifically as to the I'll use the term, excelling of the date for repayment?
My position is that we have whatever rights were on the note that we step into the shoes of, just as if we'd purchased it, just as the restatement points out.
And that was argued to the district court?
Yes, and I made this argument not only at the time of the trial, but I made the argument also in our motion to amend the order that the judge granted, and clearly pointed out once again that I didn't believe that the granting of equitable subrogation should really be at issue. It should really be the extent.
But wasn't the problem how the payments were being? You were getting the payments on your note. That was your contention in the district court, and your contention was that the equitably subordinated note and mortgage that I'm requesting is receiving no payments whatsoever.
I pointed out to the court.
Why wouldn't the payments that you've received be attributable to the equitable subordinated note?
I told the court that obviously I'm going to make the best argument for my client, which would be to increase the amount of the lien to the greatest extent. But it was up to the court to decide the extent of the lien. And I tried to make that point as clearly as I could, both in the briefing and in the oral arguments, both at the time of the trial and at the time of the motion to amend. And I made that point, I thought, very clearly, which was why I was so surprised. And the court even asked questions on that issue. And I answered those questions again. Because even if we do an allocation, even if we, you know, the original note payments were $3,800 a month, the subsequent note payments were a little more than $5,000 a month. If we applied from the $5,000 a month that we received up through the time of the trial, because after that there was a default on the note, but up through that point in time, even if we allocated those payments, $3,800 of it, to the earlier note every month, the reduction in the principal balance with the loan note accrual at the rate called for in the original note was about $9,000. I mean, it would not have reduced hardly at all the amount of the principal balance by applying those payments. But we never got there because the judge didn't, I don't want to use the word understand, I guess decided to focus on something different than I thought the court understood when I was making the arguments. Apparently, I didn't do a good enough job because I thought that equitable subrogation clearly is provided for under the restatement, under Houston case, and you're never going to have a situation where in a refinance the note terms are exactly the same as in the pre-existing note that's being refinanced. I mean, that almost never happens. So to suggest that a change in the terms of those notes should deny equitable subrogation, I think, is really unfortunate. But I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal unless there's further questions.
All right, thank you. Mr. Byrd?
Thank you. Morning, Chief Justice Perry-Gary, members of the court. May it please the court, Christopher Byrd representing Johnny Management. The issue of the change in terms of this note is really at the heart of this appeal. And this is a matter of equity. This is an equitable matter. And as an equitable matter, each case, each individual case, is decided based upon the facts and circumstances of each particular case. And what American Sterling is asking this court to do today is to create a broad, bright-line test that says, in no case where a subsequent lender pays off a preceding note and deed of trust, in no case can the intervening lien holder ever be prejudiced. That's the rule of law that they're asking this court to adopt.
Well, counsel, in the restatement, prejudice is discussed, but it's discussed in the context of a change of position by your client, not in the context of term changes of the underlying loan. Because the only subrogation that can occur is to the extent of the underlying loan. Could you comment on what seems to be the emphasis about prejudice in the restatement as opposed to the way you're approaching prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the restatement goes farther than just talking about the position, however. in comment E on the restatement. It discusses that in certain instances, an extension of the term would not be prejudicial. That's what comment E mentions in the restatement.
Mm-hmm.
So it does, in fact, discuss the term issue as part of the restatement. I would submit to the court that the converse of that is also true, that if the restatement recognizes that an extension of the term is not ordinarily prejudicial, that the converse, which would be that the drastic shortening of the term would, in fact, be prejudicial. And so I think the restatement, while there is no specific illustration on the issue, I think that the comment does speak to that, because it does discuss that ordinarily an extension of the term is not prejudicial. And I would also submit, Your Honor, that in the language of the restatement, the fact that it focuses on prejudice, the restatement would have to have been extremely long if it were to focus and define all of the instances where a trial court exercising its equitable jurisdiction and its equitable powers would be limited to find prejudice. And so I think part of the trial court's parameters and discretion in this matter was to examine the difference in terms of the loans and then make a determination, a factual determination, of whether there was material prejudice. I would also say that when the restatement is discounting the prejudice from different terms, it is looking at terms that can be changed or can be discounted with some sort of mathematical computation. It's looking at the terms that would determine what the amount owed is at the time of the default. But in this case, the real prejudice comes from the fact that there is only one note here, and that note was all due and payable in March of 2006. All $805,000 was due and payable on that date. And so if there was to be a foreclosure, we can't come back and say, well, only part of the note is being foreclosed. There's only one contract here. There's only one note. My client had the right to be able, under its cure rights under NRS 107.080, to bring current whatever is owed on a potential default and keep a position in place ahead of it.
But what I hear Mr. Girard conceding is that the most that he could get in equitable subrogation would be the interest rate and the term, even though it extended beyond the term of his note in the subrogation. And as a consequence, if there was a notice of default and election to sell, you'd be able to cure if that was the extent of the court's subrogation order. Isn't that true?
Well, that may be the concession that he is making now, but that wasn't the position that American Sterling was taking at the time of trial of this case. And secondly, that would require the court to totally rewrite the note that American Sterling entered into. American Sterling could have protected itself in this case by simply loaning $305,000 and taking a deed of trust for that amount and recording that deed of trust. It didn't do that because it wanted to make additional money.
Well, counsel, if the equitable subrogation that the court ordered was as I characterized it, you're subrogated only to the extent of the original note, deed of trust, and its terms, would your client be able to maintain a risk of default argument as prejudice?
Only to the extent that at the trial court they were asserting two things. One, that all of these, that the note was already in default, ahead of it was already in default, and that there were additional interest payments, penalties, and attorney's fees that were accruing. And that was the position they took at trial. And that was the other reason that the court found that there was inequitable conduct here on behalf of American Sterling Bank. But I think that the other issue is that American Sterling Bank is entitled to get back under the terms of the note that it agreed to $805,000 at the expiration of that note. And so you can't divide the note into different different parts. The restatement doesn't do that. The restatement says that if we are able to recompute somehow the amount that is owed at the time of the default, we can do that and not affect anyone's rights.
Well, what do you do, excuse me, with the comment A to the restatement, which Mr. Girard read, that speaks of the effect of subrogation being an assignment by operation of law? That's my first question. And my second question is, you are unjustly enriched to the extent that you're claiming the second position is just wiped out. Are you not? But the first question has to do with the operation of law and the effect of that assignment.
This is a sophisticated lender. American Sterling knows the lending business. And if it was their intent to only loan $519,000 for 6 months, which is what they, I'm sorry, if it was their intent to loan $519,000 for 15 years, then they would have taken the assignment. That wasn't their intent. Their intent was to have all $805,000 back in their hands within 6 months.
But doesn't the restatement take intent off the table?
I don't think it can, because you're creating the whole issue. Equitable subrogation is designed, or at least initially was designed, to take into account a situation where a lender would come in and refinance an obligation to save the property and to basically preserve the positions of the other lien holders. That's not what was done here. This wasn't a true refinance. This was a situation where a bank was looking to make additional funds on the money that it loaned for a short period of time. So I would submit that this assignment as a matter of law doesn't pertain in this type of case where you've shortened the term down so much. With respect to the second question, in terms of isn't my client somehow benefited because there is no second position, that would be true if, in fact, we were able to cure and keep current that second position by simply paying these $3,800 a month payments for 15 years. But that's not the deal that American Sterling made. And so you can't...
But is that the deal that equitable subrogation would make?
I don't think so, and I think...
By operation of law.
Well, I think that, as I discussed with Justice Hardesty, I think the fact that the comment in the restatement that says that in some instances the extension of the term is not prejudicial shows that the term is a critical element of equitable subrogation. And you can't create a test that says in no instance is the term irrelevant if the restatement is suggesting that in certain instances, if you extend it, it's not prejudicial to the intervening lien holder. So I would submit that the restatement, while it doesn't specifically deal with the converse, and the cases also that we cited, I believe it was the... The Hicks case, it says it is reasonable to hypothesize a scenario where Hicks could have been prejudiced, but not in this case, because the interest and term were similar. Again, while it didn't deal with a reduced term, the cases are looking at term as a critical element and making on a case-by-case basis an analysis of how does that affect the intervening lien holder. That's the whole purpose of an equitable action. It gives the court that discretion. Otherwise, the rule that American Sterling is espousing takes away the necessity for even having equitable subrogation because it doesn't become an issue. We're also dealing here with the recording statutes. I mean, that's the other issue here, the equitable subrogation. If we were to eliminate the doctrine, we go back to the straight recording statutes when first in time is first in right. And so there has to be a balance here, and sometimes the balance is in favor of the intervening lien holder, as it was in this case.
Mr. Berg, were there any major differences in the covenants of the deed of trust between the Stewart second trustee and the American Sterling trustee? Or does that even matter as far as the issues in this case?
There were a few, Your Honor, but primarily with respect to the deeds of trust, The only thing I would say would be American Sterling's deed of trust was cross-collateralized with another property. It had a substantial default interest rate in it, and the there was a there was an ability for the American Sterling to lend additional funds on an extended basis.
Yeah, I don't know if Mr. Gerard's position, I know he says he'd stand in the shoes of the steward as far as the note. I don't know about the deed of trust. So I'll be interested when he comments on that.
The deed of trust, so far as the term was really generated by the note, but the fact that that this property was cross-collateralized and the fact that American Sterling does have an opportunity to make a claim as it has on its title insurance certainly lessens the prejudice that American Sterling experiences by the district court's finding that equitable subrogation was not appropriate in this case. Unless there's any questions, I would submit that the findings of the trial court based on the prejudice from the material difference in the terms and the inequitable conduct of how the payments were applied in this case to create additional burdens on Johnny Management in order to keep its position are supported by substantial evidence and should be affirmed by this court.
Mr. Burke, can I ask you one more question? And that goes to standard of review. Now, our understanding is there was a stipulated fact submitted to the district court, and district court made its conclusions. Would the standard of review be the standard of substantial evidence clearly erroneous, or would it be de novo based on the state of this record?
I think it's substantial evidence and clearly erroneous because the court, while there were certain stipulated facts, also relied on the exhibits that were introduced in evidence and the conclusions that the court drew from those exhibits. So there were additional findings of fact that were made by the trial court that went beyond the stipulated facts. And while they were contained in some of the conclusions of law, I think that the wording of those statements by the trial court are significant. For example, in finding or conclusion of law number 7, the court stated, this court does find that the defendant showed sufficient evidence that the terms of the ASB loan and deed of trust are materially more unfavorable or prejudicial. So there is the language of a finding of fact, despite that it may have been misplaced in the opinion. The court did make additional findings of fact.
Was there any evidence other than written exhibits and stipulated facts?
No, Your Honor, there was not. If there are no other questions, I'll submit it. Thank you.
Thank you.
First of all, just to dispose of this issue that we didn't raise, the same arguments that I made to Justice Hardesty at the time of the trial, I would refer you to footnote 3 of our reply, in which we identified in the complaint, in the trial brief, and in the oral argument record where we made those exact arguments in every pleading that we filed, as well as in the oral arguments both times at the trial and on the motion to amend. So to suggest that we have ever taken a position other than that we're entitled to step into the shoes of the lien that we paid off, and to answer your question, Justice Gibbons, the restatement makes it clear that we acquire by operation of law both the underlying obligation, which in this case would be a promissory note, and the lien itself. And so we believe we stand in the shoes of both of those two documents. And in fact, in all the equitable subrogation cases that we have, which we have many, we have foreclosed many equitably subrogated liens. And we are foreclosing the deed of trust, which would have been reconveyed, but for by operation of law has been assigned to the client that has received that subrogation right. So we're always taking the position that we stand in shoes of the note and the deed of trust that would have been satisfied by the payment made by our client. And I would point out, and I think this is important, that the doctrine of equitable subrogation is founded upon established principles of equity to prevent an unjust forfeiture on the one hand and unjust enrichment on the other hand. One of the cases that counsel made reference to, this Hicks case, which I would point out to the court, is not a restatement case. It's from the Supreme Court of Colorado, but is not a restatement case. They declined to adopt the restatement in that case. But the Hicks Court stated very clearly that an intervening lien holder suffers no prejudice merely by virtue of the fact that it is not elevated in priority. And in essence, that's what is being argued, is that there is some prejudice to them by them not having an elevated priority at the expense of my client.
Well, but counsel does make an interesting argument that comment E observes that the extension of time resulting from refinancing is generally not regarded as prejudice. Therefore, the converse is true. A shortened term does.
Well, the argument is made. However, there is nothing reflected in any cases that have ever adopted the restatement that go down that path. They all go down the path that Your Honor pointed out in your first question to counsel, which is that the restatement of comment F makes it clear that what it considers to be material prejudice is a change in position, where that intervening lien holder has subsequently sold their loan to a third party, or there's a bona fide purchaser that's come in relying on the status of the public record, which shows a reconveyance of the earlier loan, that type of situation. Obviously, if you have any further questions, I'm happy to respond to those.
Any other questions? All right, counsel, thanks so much for your arguments.